Welcome to episode 51 of Upshift, the No Direction Network Essence 20 podcast that gives you an edge. Nope, sorry. I've recently started recording No Direction again, and so I've got both openings in my head, and they have similar starts but different rhythms. So let me try again. Welcome to episode 51 of Upshift, No Direction Network podcast that gives you an edge on Essence 20. I'm Ryan Costello, one of the designers of the Essence 20 system, and an author on the G.I. Joe, Transformers, My Little Pony role-playing game, core rulebooks, and so much more.
I'm Charles Cushman, and I'm on a journey to dig into the Essence 20 system, tap into Ryan's expert knowledge, and find all the little details that I, as a player or GM, would otherwise have missed.
Now, Charles, you said you wanted to build a vehicle, so I picked up this forever clever Hiss tank. It's, you know, off-brand Lego, but it is fully licensed, and so here we go. Do you just want me to hold the pieces up to the camera?
You know, instead of that, first, I would like to say that before we begin, although Ryan has worked for Renegade on Essence 20, Upshift is not associated with or produced by Renegade Game Studios. This is not an official Essence 20 broadcast or a Dollar Store Lego broadcast, and all opinions shared within are our own.
I was so focused on my bit of prop comedy that I totally forgot about the disclaimer.
But that's right. Why you have me here.
And Charles, you actually want to talk about vehicles in Essence 20. So what I brought this up?
So I'm going to... couple of things. First one is that I'm GMing a session and I absolutely want to use vehicles. The second one was that as I was reading through how to use vehicles, I was confused. Because there's a very, very small amount of information in the core rulebook about how to use vehicles. And it seems that vehicles are kind of like people, or at least treated as such. And so I wanted to find out a little bit more in detail. Why are vehicles in Essence 20 treated more like characters than equipment?
All right. Well, before we get to that, we could just look at why we even have vehicle rules. And really, if you look at the first three settings that were released for Essence 20, G.I. Joe, Power Rangers, and Transformers, vehicles all play a role one way or another. So G.I. Joe, it was a vehicle line. Like, we remember the characters probably more distinctly, but the marketing strategy was that the figures were a loss leader for these vehicles that did not cost that much to make, but because they came in a bigger box, they had a higher perceived value and so had a higher profit margin. So yeah, G.I. Joe, like the Star Wars toy line before it, 3¾ inch is the ideal size that the figure fits in your hand and a vehicle fits in your hand. Whereas when you get to like 8 inches, like they're, oh no, sorry, 6 inches, like they're doing now for classified, those vehicles are two-handed for adults. So yeah, G.I. Joe was a vehicle line, and Transformers even more so because the vehicles were the characters. And Power Rangers, of course, being a Sentai show, the summoning the Zords, which in Essence 20 terms follows a different set of rules, but still, that's the idea, that Power Rangers summon vehicles and then the vehicles form a super guy, so it goes from person to vehicle to person basically on three different scales. But one way or another, vehicles played an important role in all three of the settings, so it was important that we had the vehicle rules for all three. My Little Pony, not so much. There's, you know, trains and stuff for cross-country travel, but for the most part, they just travel by hoof or by wing. And Night Vale, I don't remember if Night Vale even has rules for vehicles. I mean, because it's based on a radio show, the getting around Night Vale is as easy as Cecil just transitioning to somewhere else. So there's no iconic vehicles, and I don't know what role vehicles would play in the story beyond what they would play in an X-Files, which is just getting you from point A to point B. There's no car chases or whatever.
So I would assume if there was a bus or something, it would just eat you.
Oh, yeah, of course. But
like
then
would
you
would... like, ooh, the bus is coming. Run! But you're running away rather than two.
But then there would be something like the sewer system full of rats, and rats is actually the Night Vale word for subway. So anyway, that's why it was important that Essence 20 have vehicle rules. However, in my experience, subsystems in role-playing games are a real pain. Mm. And the more robust they are, or the more they different, they run differently from the main game, the less likely people use them, and then the less likely people use them, the less likely people use them. Like it just becomes this diminishing return to the point that it would feel like vehicle rules are not even in the game if it's just so annoying to try and remember them. So we didn't want to do like specific rules for turning and what direction your vehicle is facing because we don't do that with characters. So we wanted to operate vehicles in the exact same, or like to move vehicles around in the scene in the exact same way you do with characters, with a couple of little nuanced rules so that things like helicopters and jets have slightly different feel, whereas like a jet needs to take off, helicopters got vertical takeoff and landing. But other than those minor instances, there's very little difference about how you run a vehicle versus how you run a character as far as movement goes. Combat is a little more fleshed out, but again, most of it is in line with the rest of the SN20 rules, and I would argue fairly intuitive.
Okay. For intuitive for most gamers, I would assume, but let's assume that you're me and not necessarily as good at intuiting the specific rules that are there. So talk to me a bit about the vehicle stats, the importance of them. Break them down for me, maybe.
Sure. So vehicles, like I said, are presented just like any other threat, but they have a couple of specific stats. So crew has the drivers and the passengers, and within the passengers is a subcategory of specific roles, which is usually gunner, but every now and then there's like a specific role, and then another perk will say, if somebody's filling this position, then they gain access to this a action. Otherwise, the only other stat you have to worry about are your weapons. So you've got hardpoint weapons, which are the ones built into it, and your fire points, which is how many people can shoot off the side. So the APC is a good example because it can have 25 passengers, but if you look at the toy, it's a long cylinder with like just a little back, so it limits the number of people that can actually fire out of it. Technically, you can remove the canopy, but anyway, the rules we went with are that only a couple of people in the APC can actually take advantage of the fact that you can shoot out of the vehicle. There is
Gotcha.
something called weapon systems, which is not as explicit that you have to look at your vehicle and look at the weapons themselves. Some of them will have a trait that says weapon systems. If it has that, then there is a rule that is a little bit inconsistent in how it's presented, unfortunately. But the driver can attack with this weapon as a free action, is what it says in the vehicle's traits. But elsewhere where it talks about hardpoint weapons, it says if a weapon has targeting system, the driver can attack as a standard action. I think I prefer free action with the caveat that it should say once per turn. Because of course characters get a lot of free actions eventually, and you cannot just go, guns blazing all the time. The reason that I like free actions more is that I like to be on the driver's side. Like if you as the player character or as the player have chosen to dedicate a chunk of your character to a system that will not come into play that often, then have fun with it, which is also why drivers get to use their driving when attacking with weapon systems. Because again, it's just thank you for your dedication to this subsystem that is important to the setting.
And talk to me a bit about vehicle traits. They seem to me a bit like modifications to equipment, but they're also a little bit like the traits of a character. So let me know.
So no, they are more like weapon traits in that some of them will have a separate set of rules attached to them, and other ones are just keywords that other rules might ping off of. So things like land, sea, and air, all vehicles have one of those designations, and that just really means depending on what kind of vehicles you're qualified to fly, or like with Scaffold, I get an extra bonus for flying vehicles with the disadvantage. It's the skyward influence. So my hang up is that I am worse at non-flying vehicles, but great at flying vehicles. And the way you know that, even though you would probably instinctively be able to tell whether something is a land, sea, or air vehicle, is that we throw in a little trait like that. But a couple of other ones, like autopilot. Autopilots are important because they just make things easier on the driver. So it means that if you have multiple, if your vehicle's crew requirement requires two drivers, but you have an autopilot, you actually only need the one, and so you can use the autopilot to fill in the other role, or if the other role is filled, then the co-pilot and the autopilot can both give the driver's lens assistance. And then autopilot advanced is when you do not even need a driver, but one is nice. But technically, the vehicle can move without it. And linked is another one that you need to look at your vehicle's weapons stats. If they have that trait, you get an edge on those attacks. So that is a big, easily missed bonus. And then other stuff is like takeoff and landing, whether you get VTOL or whether you need a runway. And finally, wearable is fun, but you'll understand when it comes up because that's for mechs and stuff. Most vehicles are not wearable.
Oh, I thought you were talking about those backpack things that they used to have, the motorized backpacks and the little
I wish we could have
wheelers.
gotten into those more, and I realized after the Quartermaster's Guide came out, I was like, oh, I could have spent more time working on the motorized backpacks because I love those. They are a guilty pleasure of mine. So most of the specifics to the vehicle beyond what's in that opening section, so page 170 to 170, I think it's just 172. No, to 170, yes, sorry, 170 to 172. Most of it is summed up in that crew, hardpoints, and firepoints section. There's also every vehicle has a long and drawn out explanation that it is a vehicle and as a vehicle, etc. I grew to resent how much space I dedicated to this for every single vehicle, and I tried to summarize it, and sometimes the editor would be like, oh no, that breaks format, and then put the whole chunk back in there. And sometimes they did the adapted version where it just said it's a vehicle. The only place you'll get new information is the Field Guide to Action Adventure, which has a section on vehicle threat design on page 151, 152. And then on page 204, we actually expand on vehicle combat to make things a little clearer, which includes a little more explanation in how attacks work, how you can have multiple drivers for a single vehicle, which can be a little confusing. It makes overdrive official. So that was one of the questions people had of can you use your standard action to move the vehicle faster like you can for a character? My instinct was yes, because again, we wanted it to be moving a vehicle is almost exactly the same as moving a character. Other people were like, no, logically, a vehicle can only move as fast as it can. I won out. I managed to get the rules officially published in the book before anyone else. And so that is the official rule that you can use your standard action to move your vehicle its movement again. It also has just a section called skillful driving, which is just to show that how using a skill other than just drive works. And I should say, one of the reasons that driving is a move action instead of a standard action is so that you can still feel like your character when you are driving, because most of your character's perks are standard actions. And so you're operating the vehicle with your drive skill, using the drive skill only if something comes up that needs a skill test. But otherwise, you're using your drive skill, sorry, you're using your move action to move the vehicle's movement, and you are rolling your whatever skills you want to do the things that you want to do during the round.
So let's see if I'm getting it correct then. Essentially, what happens is that and when you're piloting a vehicle, you are using that vehicle stats to replace your own for the purposes of attacking, movement, those various different skills, save for the drive one, which is the one that you use in order to deal with significant issues related to driving. Everything else, include like you would use your targeting. To use the weapons, but everything else that you would do using the vehicle stats. Oh, okay.
All right,
So this
vehicle
is why
skills.
I asked these
Vehicles have
questions.
lists of skills drawn from the same skills characters have access to. These represent what the vehicle is capable of when crewed by at least one driver. When the GM calls upon a vehicle to make skill tests, determine whether the situation calls for the skills of the vehicle, a driver, or a passenger filling a secondary crew position. So in the example, you've got Wild Bill is flying a Skyhawk, and they fly over a camouflaged Cobra missile turret. So the question is, do you use the Skyhawk's alertness, which is a D4, which represented having a radar, or do you use Wild Bill's alertness, which in this example was a D6, which is better than the radar, but given the context of the situation, would it make more sense that he could only spot this thing using the radar, or would he be able to look out the window at the speed that he was traveling and still be able to identify something with his eyes? Like, would that be an upshift or a snagged situation, or would it be a situation where the GM says, you cannot use your alertness, but you can use the vehicle's alertness?
So if they're in the darkness, for instance, the radar would probably be more useful than the eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is difficult for me to wrap my brain around trying to treat a vehicle like a person, and a person which is, I guess, containing another person.
Well, just because it has stats doesn't mean it's a person. It just means it's a thing with stats.
Okay. The one thought I had, which led to this episode, was why does my tank have a place for a social stat? It is, you know, okay, it's certainly intimidating. When that was designed, what was the push other than like to try and make it not complicated or a subsystem? How was that designed?
All right. So I will say I'm the one that designed the vehicle rules. So I designed vehicles and I designed the entire G.I. Joe equipment chapter. And as we've said, that was the basis for the equipment chapter in Transformers and Power Rangers. Even though Power Rangers published first, the G.I. Joe equipment rules were written first and then adapted to the other settings. And so that included writing the rules for the vehicle stats. And I couldn't write the vehicle stats without having vehicle rules. So eventually I had to do the vehicle rules. The starting point was a vehicle should have the same stat block, so the same format as a character, so that when you look in a stat block, you instantly recognize where everything is. So your skills, your stats, everything like that. Now, when we're talking about vehicle combat, there's really like three different ways you can define that. One of them is that the PCs are all on foot and they are fighting a vehicle, possibly a combination of a vehicle and people on foot, but just there is a vehicle on that side. The opposite is everyone's in a vehicle, it's vehicles versus vehicles. And then finally, there's the generally rare version where the PCs are in a vehicle and they are fighting targets on foot. So when you say vehicle combat, what are you looking for? Are you looking for all of that or are you looking for something more specific?
I mean, all of those scenarios are good. Vehicle versus vehicle, I think, would be the one that I would like to see an example of that would play out. But the other ones are very interesting. Let's talk about a vehicle to vehicle combat.
Okay. So let's start with the point that the players get into the vehicle. You assign your crew. So every vehicle has the crew stat, and it says how many drivers the vehicle has, how many passengers the vehicle has, and any specific role a passenger has to fill. So right now I've got the APC queued up. APC is a vehicle that only has one driver, can have up to 25 passengers, one of which can be the gunner of the 105mm recoilless cannon. So everyone gets in and someone needs to be the driver. Nobody needs to be the gunner yet, but if somebody is in the gunner position right off the bat, then that's good to know when a combat starts. So like you just need to declare who's driving. They're in the driver's seat. Generally, you're then just moving the vehicle's movement. You don't need to make any driving skill test unless a situation calls for it, in the same way that you might need to make an acrobatic situation skill test or an athletic skill test when you're on foot. So if you're just driving in a straight line across the highway or even just making some basic maneuvering, that's fine. It's really up to the GM to decide, okay, now is a situation where you and the vehicle are having a bit of a fight and you have to prove to the vehicle that you've got the skills to get it to do what you want. And you make the skill test, the GM also has to decide what happens if you fail the skill test. Like if you're making a sharp turn and you fail the skill test, you can imagine that you didn't make it sharp enough and you might collide with something. You know, again, the context and the GM decide ultimately what happens in that failed skill test, but the vehicle doesn't get destroyed. It doesn't get flipped. It's just based on the context, it's probably a minor to medium inconvenience.
Okay. And how would you use vehicle-to-vehicle combat in an adventure? Let's say you're putting one together. When is it appropriate to use them, and how can they make the experience more fun?
So when is logical? Like, it's usually when I'm writing the adventure, I'll just start writing it and, If I come up to a point and it's like, oh, a chase scene belongs in here, I'll plug in a chase scene. It's rare that I will go into it and I'll be like, this needs a chase scene. I take it back that actually I deliberately make sure there's a chase scene every time Autobots are involved, just so that their alt mode does play into it more than just, being tall or small. But yeah, so a vehicle I would put in there if we're just running a homebrew campaign, not a published adventure. If it's been too long since there was a vehicle situation, I might be like, it's time for a vehicle. Let's say, oh, you've got to drive into this situation. Here's the vehicle at your disposal, or fly into it, or whatever. The flying and the sea vehicles are good for adding setting a tone for the locale, because it has to be reached before you can even have the adventure. And you can put in countermeasures preventing the vehicle, and that becomes a vehicle combat situation or just a vehicle skill test. And yeah, ground vehicles, it's mainly just when it would be fun or when it's been a while, because technically anything you can reach on ground, you can also just have them dropped off by a helicopter that flies away and then you just go into it. Also, deciding whether you're doing it depends on how your party has invested in the driving skill. If you never do vehicles, you are punishing anyone that has the driving skill test, that has a driving skill invested. If you do vehicles too frequently, you make your party feel like they have to invest in the driving skill. And so generally, along a long-term campaign, you will figure out whether you've got the one main driver or if you've got a couple of people that can achieve driving, that can drive fairly well, and that tells you what mix of vehicle combat you could put in. So, like in our group, I believe that I'm Scaffold is the only one with any driving skills, and so when there is somewhere to go, generally Scaffold is the one driving it. Although often Eric will give us an NPC, and I kind of would rather if he didn't. Like, it's one of my things. Just let me drive, even if I never have to make a skill test. Just say I am sitting in that chair because that's the chair I belong to. If you have multiple people with driving, then you can look at the vehicles that need two drivers or multiple smaller vehicles, like having a couple of, we don't have the Silver Mirage, but I think the Ram has a sidecar function that lets you use the Ram stats for the Silver Mirage. Let me just double check. Driver, yeah, one driver and one passenger. So yeah, you can get a couple of people on there so that one person is handling the driving while somebody else is the passenger and then using their skills and their perks however they feel they can.
That two driver thing was very interesting. How did that come about in design?
The needs of certain vehicles. Like, a lot of the time it's look at the toy. What does the toy do? What role do certain things achieve? Like, the Rolling Thunder is clearly two drivers. And so the way it's represented is, again, the simplest version possible. Let me just see where it specifically says. All right, drivers, the vehicle's main and most important crew is the driver. Without a driver, vehicle cannot move. It's treated like an object. If a vehicle lists multiple drivers, it can move as long as it has one driver, but only half its movement. It can only move at full speed with its full complement of drivers. Only one driver makes the skill tests. The additional drivers lend assistance on the driving skill test.
You were talking about designing around vehicle combat, potentially for a professional product or homebrew. How do you balance threat ratings, and how does that work? Is it, how does one large versus a whole bunch of small, or should we always try and have it kind of an average threat rating between the one or two different vehicles? Those methods of those issues of balance, how does that work?
So the Field Guide to Action Adventure tells you how to calculate threats when you've got, sorry, threat levels when you've got vehicles involved. I'll just read out some of what it says here. So, for example, four sixth-level PCs in a pair of vamps, which are threat level four each, face off against a Cobra officer, threat level five, and a motor rifle, threat level three, in a HISS tank, threat level five. So on the PC side, you calculate everybody, you add all the threat levels together, divide by four, because four is the perceived average party. And so that's where the numbers are built around that. So that includes adding your vehicle in there and then dividing it up. So ultimately, you will have a higher total threat level because you are dividing a larger number than four by four. So just ultimately, even though it's a party of six level PCs, your average will be, it's 32 divided by four, so eight. So in that case, six level parties, but just the inclusion of two vamps means that you can handle up to threat level 8 as a typical encounter. And now we see if the Cobra Officer, Motor Viper, and Hiss represents a threat level 8, like an appropriate challenge. So the core rulebook presents two different ways you can calculate threat level for threats. Anytime you see that there are two versions of something, one of them is the simple way that will produce a less accurate number, and then the other one is the hard way that if this was a less straightforward RPG, would have just been the default. So I usually take the more complicated one as the default, you get a better number. So in this case, calculating the threat of multiple NPCs is calculated called using the greatest threat and half the rest. So we've got a threat level 5. We've got two threat level 5s, in fact. So we take one of those 5s and then we add everything else together and divide it by 2. So 5 plus 3 plus 5 is 8. So 5 plus 4 means that this is effectively a threat level 9. And we know the PCs can handle threat level 8 on average. So this will be a slightly tougher than average encounter, which should work out for everybody.
Excellent. Okay. That is, it's very good to have that. Oh, continue.
You're just saying, if you're talking about Transformers, ignore all of that because the vehicles are part of the threat, and so you don't calculate them separately.
Their alt modes are taken into account when their threats are calculated, so.
Exactly. Same thing for Zords. Zord is a role feature. It's a role perk, and so you don't treat it as a separate vehicle. It's something that you can just use sometimes.
One of the interesting things when I was reading it through, and sometimes I'll click on one specific word or two in a sentence and go, well, there's some design space there.
Okay.
The book says that vehicles have no smarts or essence, social essences by default. Can you explore that statement for a little? And what would, assuming that that default wasn't the case, how would you potentially use smarts or social in vehicles that were not Transformers?
So here's something funny. In the G.I. Joe core rulebook on page 172, when it lists all the vehicle traits, powers, and perks, there is a perk called AI. The vehicle has smarts and social essence scores as well as willpower and cleverness. It can be targeted with conditions, although it's still immune to frightened. I don't know why I said it's immune to frightened, but there we go. So its drivers, willpower, and target and cleverness can still be targeted. So, based on the situation, if you know you're looking at a talking car with a driver and you know you can't frighten the car, you might start targeting the driver instead. The vehicle itself gains free actions. Anyway, so there is a trait in here to represent how to give a vehicle smarts and social scores. No vehicle in the JoJo role-playing game has the AI trait. This is one of those situations where, in the world that we've created based on these rules, this rule makes sense. But in adapting the setting, it never comes up.
Fair enough. Yeah, I can't think of anything where, I don't know, there was any evolution associated with the Joe vehicles. describe for me maybe, let's say that we wanted Knight Rider's kit. Would that be a good use of the AI function?
That would be, in fact, something that I said that there's no G.I. Joe vehicle with smarts or social skills, but there is a Power Rangers vehicle in right from the core rulebook. I had the Lightning Cruiser. There we go. So it's on page 125 of the Power Rangers core rulebook. There is the Lightning Cruiser, which has a social and a smarts, and therefore all of those things that I just read apply. It gets free actions. It gets its own turn, and it's less of, so that's where it's less a tool and more another member of the party. So in that case, GMs would generally run it as an NPC on the PC side, or if a PC wants to take over the decisions it's making, but still have to acknowledge that this is separate in that it is a sentient character.
Okay. That would make sense. Yeah, I just thought about it probably wouldn't be, it might be very interesting actually to have a player character be a vehicle. That might be
And
an
not a
interesting.
transformer?
And not a transformer, just merely an awakened vehicle.
Okay. Then kit, like you were saying, the perfect example of that.
How would essence attacks work against a vehicle? Would it work just like they work against a player?
So my philosophy is that apply any rules through a context lens. So if a perk that lets you attack essence scores says you are cutting an artery or whatever, vehicles don't have arteries. But they do have like oil pipelines and whatnot. I don't know mechanics enough to know what the proper.
Hydraulics.
There you go. Yes. So there are things that could bleed out. So then the conversation between the GM and the player is, does what you want to do and the flavor of the rule apply to this vehicle, even though it wasn't intended for it? So for the most part, vehicles have unwritten immunities, like you cannot trip a plane.
That you'd be surprised how often that comes up.
I know. But yeah, it all just comes down to context and the GM's instincts. So, which was part of why we part of the design philosophy that Essence 20 had to be a fairly light game means that these corner cases are left in the GM's hands.
And by the way, in like 18 months or so, you're all going to find that very funny. Last question, I guess, is with the wisdom you've gained in the development system, is there anything you'd change about vehicles if you were to invent them again today?
Like I've called out a couple of things that it was like, this could have been streamlined, this could have been clearer, this space could have been used more efficiently. But in general, no, I like how the vehicles work, and I like that you are rewarded for being the driver. That is something that was really important to me, having played in other campaigns and whatnot, where a character is dedicated to a thing that just never comes up. Like being the cleric that is the master of turning undead in a campaign where the undead never show up. And so, yeah, vehicles, it's not G.I. Joe, it's not any of these settings without vehicles. And there's no point in putting the vehicles in there if nobody's going to invest in driving.
Talk to me briefly about how many vehicles and things are covered within the General Hawk book.
Oh, General Hawk only throws in a couple of vehicles. So one of them was the Mobat, which, of course, G.I. Joe's first tank, one that I resent because it's got a stupid name and because there's no room for figures in it. My like of a vehicle depends on its space for crew versus its footprint. And the Mobat fails that test very much because technically the driver doesn't even get in. You just can put the person in the turret. So anyway, but of course, my personal preference should only affect what content goes into the JoJo role-playing game so much. And so when I was working out that first chapter of the 1982 crew, I realized I could squeeze in the Mobat, and then that's a major box that's been checked. Because otherwise, most iconic vehicles are covered mostly in the core rulebook. The Quartermaster covers a couple of other ones, depending on your definition of iconic, like the Havoc. But yeah, Hawks wasn't really meant to be a vehicle book.
Throw us to the shout outs.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for episode 51 of Upshift. If you'd like to hear other great gaming podcasts we produce, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you'd like to chuck in a buck to just thank us for the work we do, you can go to our Patreon, patreon.com/nodirection. And of course, I want to thank Word Burglar for the use of letters from Snake Eyes Part 4. You can find out more at wordburglar.com. Until next time, I'm Ryan Costello.
And I'm Charles Cushman.
This has been Upshift.
My main meditation was taking them down. My pain medication, Shanna saw.